All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. And welcome, one and all, to episode 27 of the SLS Cast. I don't know why I just talked that way, but hey, we do what feels good around here.
I think deep down inside, you just really want to be hosting a game show. Not a podcast, but a game show. I think you should be the one hosting The Price is Right.
Well, unfortunately, since I look like Drew Carey before and not after, I don't think they'd put me on. Maybe if I had gone before he lost his weight, then I might have had a chance. But I mean, I could do it. Well, tell him what he's won, Johnny. You know, that kind of thing. And go ahead, sing along. You don't know the words.
If you got to pick a game show to host, what would it be?
Like past, present, or future? Or does it have to be a currently existing show?
No, any show.
I would probably have to say Tic-Tac-Doe.
Tic-Tac-Doe?
Oh, yes. It was a fantastic game show where you would answer trivia questions in category. It was kind of like if you mashed up Jeopardy, except you don't answer in the form of a question. But it's kind of like if you mashed up Jeopardy with Hollywood Squares, but there's no celebrities. You're literally just trying to play tic-tac-toe. And you're winning money, and then there was like this dragon. But of course, this is like 1984, so the dragon is like looks like a really bad version of Pete's dragon. You don't want to get that dragon because then you like lose the game or whatever. It was kind of crazy and stuff, but it was really fun. I remembered being able to answer some of the questions when I was a kid, and I liked the flashing lights and stuff. And one time, Ernest P. Worrell was on the show, and that is really cool. So I would say that would be my show.
I think I would have to do Hollywood Squares. The original Hollywood Squares with Paul Lynn and all those guys. Back when game shows were fun and it was all about making people laugh and not necessarily winning anything, but just having a good time.
Indeed.
So.
Indeed. And in case we never got there, this is the SLS Cast.
Oh yeah, I don't think we even touched on that.
I don't know that we actually got there or not. But yes, that's, and I'm Matt. I'm Matt.
And I am Tim.
Very cool.
Think I am. That's what I.
Well, you know, ever since
told.
The last purge.
Ever since that last double-double from In-N-Out I had. Which I gotta say, why would anyone, of course, if you can afford a $3 hamburger, but why would you bypass In-N-Out just to go to a McDonald's or a Jack in the Box? Ever. Because, I don't know, I In-N-Out is the ultimate burger, and I think I realized that, in fact, there is a difference in buying a burger that has sautéed onions than it having just regular onions. In fact, I think sautéed onions taste better, therefore make me fuller and much happier. And my idea is that if I ate a burger with regular onions, I would not be in a good mood right now. I don't know why, but I just think that.
So does this mean that your purge diet thingy, master cleanser, how'd that go?
That lasted about 3 days. A day shorter than what I was trying to go for the full 4 days, but by the third day, I was kind of running out of my juice mix, so I figured, well, instead of spending like $20 to replenish my juice mix only to do it for another day, I'm just going to go ahead and end it a day short. But I think, you know, 3 days was good enough. I felt cleansed enough. Things were flowing smoothly, I guess.
Did you lose your weight? Do your shirts fit now?
They did. I don't know about right now after eating a a double-double. I might have to do it again before the wedding. For another 2 or 3 days. But
I see. Yeah. I see. Okay, well that's good to know. These are the things that are important to know. As far as that goes, I can imagine that maybe there are people who don't like In-N-Out. I've never had an In-N-Out burger.
Really?
They opened up in Dallas after I moved out, and the last time I was in Vegas was the first time I'd ever heard about it, and I didn't get a chance to go then, and I've never been to where they have one around me, so
I'm gonna UPS you one next day. Okay. Air.
You do that. You go right on ahead, sir.
Not sure how the quality of it would be, but might be a little,
well,
wilty.
According to you, it shouldn't matter. It should
true
still...
true should be still be delicious, even better if not had time to ferment in the
age in
the box.
it's aging, yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. That's good. So, I guess anything fun and exciting happening for you this last week?
No. Just a lot of sun. Been very nice weather here, opposed to Houston, which I hear has been very thundery and rainy the past couple
weeks. It has, but more, it's still been just as sunny as it has been rainy, so we haven't had any really bad issues or anything like that to this point. I think it's been a nice balance to counteract those drought conditions that the rest of the United States is getting. It truly is feast or famine weather-wise everywhere else, so I guess we'll just be content with what we can get. I, too, have had pretty much, it's just been standard busyness about the weeks, keeping track of the kids and trying to go to work and see movies and edit the show and get with family and blah, blah. So, other than that, nothing really noteworthy, except for you for next week. Should we go ahead? You should tell them. Tell them now that you're officially, that you're going to be gone next week.
Well, guys, I've been selected on a mission. For those who don't know, I am a medaled Navy SEAL, and I've been chosen to lead a top secret mission to the hills of Killarney in Ireland to solve the Great Potato Famine that has apparently come back to the Irish hillside, and they needed my manliness, my brawn, to beat the fungus, and my scientific brain to help come up with a scientifically way of beating the fungus. That is why I'm going to Killarney, Ireland, to beat that old monstrous potato famine. It's a horrible thing. It's a crisis that I have been lobbying for the past, 35 years or so. So I'm glad that I've been chosen to put an end to it, Matt. I'm happy. I'm happy to serve this country, God damn it. Really, I'm going to Hawaii to get some sun and a vacation. A much-needed vacation in Hawaii.
Well, I'm glad that you're going to have a nice week off. So we'll have a special guest next week filling in for Tim. We have a little bit of a modified show. Since we have someone that we have to break in, it's a mutual friend of ours. His name is Sam. And he's going to be filling in for Tim next week. And so due to that, we're only going to be covering the movies. Next week, we're going to skip Three Squared and news and stuff. But we're just going to delve right into the movies. We're going to really break him in right. But then the week after that, though, Tim will be back. We'll be back right on schedule. And that could very well have been what she said as well. I think then, since this has been pretty boring and whatnot and everything, we should just jump right into it. Shall we jump right into it, Tim?
We shall.
Then it is time for the news!
The news, we are doing
yes.
The news.
Newsy, newsy news. Alright, so, who's gonna go first, Tim?
You go, sir.
But I don't have that car. But I'm bum bum. All right. Let's see here. From the Hollywood Reporter, courtesy of Yahoo Movies, turns out that there is a $20 million salary standoff for Johnny Depp. I said essentially a lot last week. You people need to tell me these things. I said essentially like 250,000 times. All right. Let's try this again. We have a $20 million salary standoff with Johnny Depp going on here between Cross Creek and Exclusive Media and Johnny Depp. This is about the biopic for Whitey Bulger. They are saying that Johnny Depp had agreed to, and according to some people, it was penned. So this was a done deal for $20 million to do this picture. Other people say it wasn't quite set in stone. And as a result, Cross Creek and Exclusive Media are asking him to drop from 20 to 10. And he walked off the picture. He said, no, goodbye, I'm out. The problem here is that there are two different sides to the story. One is it was on lock. He was supposed to get the $20 million, and that was it. Okay? But according to Cross Creek, well, sources, these are all sources. So you've got the one side in the Depp camp saying, he's gone. He's not coming back. You guys told him it was going to be $20 million. This deal was done, and now you're trying to get him to say 10. The Cross Creek side is basically saying, well, that was not the fine print. It was a done deal, but the fine print was the film budget was going to be required to stop at $50 million. But the budget has come in at $63 million. So they have asked everybody, including Joel Edgerton, to drop their salaries to make up the $13 million. It's pretty telling when apparently they're asking one guy to pay to drop 10 and then everybody else to come up with the three. Maybe somebody's making just a little more money than everybody else.
Just a little bit.
Maybe just a little.
Just a little bit.
But either way, it's kind of sad because apparently there are people, another source is like, quote, the situation is absurd. You would never have a star of Depp's magnitude and not have all of the deals preconditioned buttoned down before taking it to market. Either his team screwed up and left him exposed, or Cross Creek is simply reneging on its deal. Someone is suing someone at the end of this, end quote. Long story short here, apparently there are sets waiting for Depp to come back. Some people are saying he's gone, forget it, he's not coming back. Other people are like, well, never say never, things could work out and he could come back. They, however, have to be getting going within the next couple of weeks because Barry Levinson has a February 2014 start date in China for the Mike Medavoy-produced drama The Cursed Piano. And a minimal crew apparently remains in place in Boston for Black Mass, though another source disputes that the crew is still in place. Yet Cross Creek is saying that additional crew is heading out to the location in the coming days. And Depp, as of last checked, was supposed to join the set on August 12th. So this will be kind of interesting. I'm hoping to see that there will be some sort of resolution. They are actually looking at replacing him. There are, again, tertiary sources coming in to say that if Depp does drop out, they're going to try and get Tom Cruise to fill in.
Really? To play Whitey Bulger?
Yes! Who is on trial for murdering 19 people?
Interesting.
I just want to see how this turns out. Go ahead, sorry.
Well, no, it's interesting that we're having to see, like, all this is happening with money. Like, something like this has to go on with money, and this is happening with an art form. People that are taking part in what should be a form of art, being movies, are arguing about money. You never hear about painters arguing about money. I know movies is a little bit different from art, but still, you know, it's a damn art form. You're making a biography about a historical person, somebody from history, from more recent history. But still, I mean, it's just ridiculous. Honestly, if you think about it, at least to me, is there really a difference between making $60 million for a movie than maybe making $35 million for a movie? I don't think so. You know, it's just weird. It just seems like a lot of these actors don't want to go down from their high paycheck just to prove a point. So,
well, the article, it's interesting that you bring that up. Now, this is again from the article. The actor who next stars in Disney's The Lone Ranger is known to take pay cuts for passion projects. He will make less than $1 million up front for Disney's Into the Woods with director Rob Marshall. I guess maybe they were hoping that he just felt that strongly about it, that he would come back and take less money.
Yeah.
Maybe they thought he was a little bit more passionate about this project than he was. I don't know.
Oh, well. That's why I like the Paul Giamatti's and the Greg Kinnear's, because you can just tell that they make artful movies, or they make movies that they think are good. They're not asking for $60 million to do these movies, and they're willing to take chances. So, unfortunately,
do you
with
think
Johnny...
It's because, but do you think it's because they have nothing to lose? Or do you think it's because they're respected enough to only be given scripts that are worthy of their talent?
Well, I think they know that there are some movies that they are in that aren't good. For instance, Paul Giamatti was in The Hangover 2. He was the villain. Why was he doing it? He probably did it just to have a good time. You know, just to do a fun little movie. But I don't know about if they're respected enough to not be given, or to be expected to do crappy movies, or not to do amazing movies. But I think a lot of people really don't ever think about Greg Kinnear, or even Paul Giamatti, in their list of favorite actors. So,
I think the general movie going public, I would agree with that. The general movie going public would be like, Greg Kinnear, man, wasn't he some gay dude with Jack Nicholson like 10 or 12 years ago or something like that? I think you're right, because most people are only going to think about the big starring vehicles where people get paid $20 million just to show up. So does that make Robert Downey Jr. any less of an actor because he's getting $60, $80 million for Iron Man and stuff like that?
An actor is an actor. An actor can do play many different roles and still be considered an actor. I mean, you can be Robert Downey Jr. and be a part of the Avengers, and still be a good actor. It's, you know, he's just a different kind of actor. But then again, you don't see Robert Downey Jr. or Johnny Depp turning around and making these little indie movies. Instead, you see Johnny Depp in The Lone Ranger playing another character. Granted, the movie looks good, and he looks good in it, like in every other movie he's in. But still, he's trying to, or he's continuing to appeal to mainstream audiences.
But he didn't always. I mean, you're talking about a dude who also bounced out of Gilbert Grape and Benny and June.
Great, and he did Ed Wood. But it's kind of gotten out of hand. I mean,
absolutely. Like I've said before, I'm all for making as much money as you possibly can. However, I don't know. For me, it kind of defies logic because, on one hand, I am for, hey, if you can get $80 million, by God, go get $80 million.
Right.
But then you, by doing so, you suck the pool so dry for everybody else to get a shot to come in that you can't give Greg Kinnear $10 million to do a picture because that's not the quality that's not the quality that moviegoers want to see. Doesn't matter that he's good. Paul Giamatti, same thing. I guess what I'm getting at is that the Greg Kinnears of the world, the Paul Giamattis of the world, they are where they are because of a conscious decision to not try and be a Robert Downey Jr., to not try and be a Tom Cruise or a Johnny Depp or a Will Smith, where you're actively going after tens of millions of dollars for a picture. They decided that they wanted to just be an actor. And if they get a great payday, then fine. But they want to do the parts that they want to be able to pick and choose and do what they want to do and the consequences be damned, so long as they're happily making movies.
Right.
And I guess that's what I was getting at originally. So, long way down. Good for everybody. Next up, Joss Whedon. This comes from comicbook.com. Joss Whedon says, no Avengers 2 without Robert Downey Jr. And I'm going to sum this one up. This is a pretty easy one to sum up. When asked by the Daily Beast how crucial Robert Downey Jr. is to the Avengers sequel, Joss Whedon said, quote, he is Iron Man. He is Iron Man in the way that Sean Connery was James Bond. I have no intention of making Avengers 2 without him, nor do I think I'll be called upon to do that. End quote. And let's face it, he's right. However, we do live in a world where people will say, okay, Joss Whedon, that's fine. You're just not going to direct.
Yeah, no,
you're
exactly.
Just not going to direct the next movie. Okay.
They have a long line of directors to choose from.
Exactly. And to those who would say that it would be the kiss of death to not have Joss Whedon come back, then I say to you, Fast and Furious. And people are like, what? Because I do not recall the director's name, which is kind of a bummer. Director's name of Fast and Furious worked with Vin Diesel. When they wouldn't bring Vin Diesel back, he said, I'm not coming back either. So then they tried to get Vin Diesel, but then they were both like, if one doesn't come back, you can't get the other. It was a package deal. So they ended up scrapping it, and they made the second movie anyway. The second movie, of course, tanked because didn't have Vin Diesel and it didn't do whatever. But there was still enough life left in the franchise to get one last movie out where they just begged and begged and begged and they got Vin Diesel to come back for like a 30-second cameo at the end of the third movie. And when they did that, kaboom! Franchise back on. Fast and Furious 4, Fast and Furious 5, and then we have the 80, 90, 100 million grossing Fast and Furious 6 that just happened.
And then next year, Fast and Furious 7.
Well, I just think it's really interesting because it just goes to show Fast and Furious is a franchise that just absolutely goes to show you that even though it looks bleak now and even though nobody knows how it's all going to turn out and who knows what the hell is going to happen, especially considering that The Avengers 2 is scheduled to be released in movie theaters in the United States on May 1st, 2015. So they got to get going. Even if they can't get Robert Downey Jr., I think this is going to be one of those things where it'll all turn out okay in the end.
Because, you know, Marvel cannot screw up.
More likely. And Wheaton, and again, from the same article, here from the article, it says, Wheaton also said, quote, I don't think it's in my interest, Marvel's interest, or his interest, and I think everything will be fine. But I know that this is Hollywood, and you roll with things. You have to be ready for the unexpected. But I loved working with Robert, and everybody knows he embodied that role in a way no one else can, end quote. So it sounds like people are starting to take a little bit more of a pragmatic approach, and I think once things calm down and they really start settling into the pipeline to get principal photography started, I think we'll see everything fall into place. But if not, don't lose all hope. Next up, turns out that the TSA will stop at nothing to make sure that everyone has a bad experience. They don't care who they fuck with. They fucked with Chewbacca. Chewbacca! I'm telling you! Yes! Peter Mayhew was actually detained. They took his cane away from him.
Oh, no, you did not.
Because it looks like a lightsaber.
Really?
Yes. It's a pretty badass one, too. It's like this blue kind of crystal looking. And then, of course, it's, you know, got a lightsaber handle on it. This comes to us from The Hollywood Reporter as well. It says here that Peter Mayhew, the actor who portrayed Chewbacca in the Star Wars films, apparently took issue with airport security after they spotted his lightsaber-style cane. Mayhew documented his frustration and vindication on Twitter. And I love how he puts the writing that TSA, quote, won't allow me through the airport with me cane, end quote. He posted multiple photos of the incident last Monday in which TSA officers appear with the cane as Mayhew waits. Quote, though after I tweeted, they gave it back, end quote. The actor, who has over 22,000 followers on Twitter, wrote. And this makes me very happy, this next little sentence here. The actor was flying home from Denver Comic-Con to his home in Texas when the trouble began. That's right. Quote, in Dallas, thank you to @AmericanAir for checking on me. Problem was all at TSA. I'm a million miler on American, and they are a class act, end quote, Mayhew wrote. And to close it all out, the actor also retweeted an astronomer who noted the sage advice of Han Solo in tough situations. TSA, quote, just learned Star Wars lesson number one, let the Wookiee win.
I wonder if the TSA agents, like, posed with the cane.
I have no idea, but I mean, come on.
Hey, Larry, you know, take a picture.
If it had just been a regular person, okay, I could see why someone would question the validity of, is that really a cane, or do I get to be a dick? But how the hell do you not notice Peter Mayhew? Forget that you may not know what Peter Mayhew looks like, but how many 7'3" old dudes who are clearly in need of a cane that looks like a lightsaber do you know? And when you see that, you could probably, man, that guy's tall enough, he could have played you, but I wonder, oh my god, it just seems like it would put it together. I don't know. We are dealing with the TSA here, so maybe I'm giving them too much credit for thinking that far ahead. Movie Talk on Yahoo Movies says that Jim Carrey's career kicked in the shins as Dumb and Dumber 2 fumbles. Yes, folks, Dumb and Dumber 2 has been kicked to the curb, making for the latest blow to Jim Carrey's career. Warner Brothers' decision to pass on the Dumb and Dumber sequel comes hot on the heels of the box office failure of The Incredible Burt Wonderstone, a film that had a similar budget but grossed only $22 million domestically. Carrey received good reviews for his portrayal of a Criss Angel-like street magician, but the film failed to connect with audiences. I think overall that the film did better than they thought it was going to do, but I really think that they're just trying too hard, because we covered this movie.
We did.
And neither one of us hated the movie.
No. I enjoyed it more than you did.
I believe, yes, that is true. And coming from someone who likes magic, you know, that's definitely saying something. I really think, honestly, that they're just putting... This is where too much money becomes a problem, because now they're paying these people ridiculous salaries that they're never going to be able to bounce back from. And then the movies don't make any money, and then it's like, oh, you guys are paid too much and you guys suck. Well, the movie wasn't necessarily bad, but I think that that is a prime reason why you should budget correctly in Hollywood. I don't think it was Jim Carrey's fault. I don't think he did anything bad. But I don't know. It just seems to be that everybody just wants to focus on the money that he used to make as why he should just automatically get the money today. They actually say here, Carrie, a box office powerhouse who could command $20 million per film back in the 90s and early 00s, has been having a rough time of it lately. His last starring vehicle was Mr. Popper's Penguins, which was released 2 years ago this month and only earned $68 million domestic on a budget of $55 million. Despite the fact that he's always an engaging performer and also does well in edgier projects such as I Love You, Philip Morris, and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Carrie just doesn't have the mainstream appeal that he used to. I think that that's correct. I think that because when he was getting that kind of money, he was doing a lot of the projects that he was, I don't want to say typecast for, but known for. Yes, he had the occasional breakout with, like, The Truman Show, for example. But a lot of it was, there were definitely more mask-type things and Ace Ventura style films than
there were a lot better than what he's doing now.
True, and even still though, but even compared to when he was doing better, there were still more of those films than there were films like The Truman Show or films like Bruce Almighty, which I think Bruce Almighty was definitely one of those where he had a perfect opportunity to kind of make that switch into a better comedy without having to be physical and over the top and slapstick. And yet, here we are today. Although, looking on that, when he had his shirt off and everything for Incredible Burt Wonderstone, I did forget that he's 51.
Oh, he is 51, isn't he?
Yeah, so he's looking good for 51. You gotta give him that.
He's going to be one of those guys that just... even when he's probably 71, he's going to still look like he's 35.
Hey, they had a picture on Reddit the other day of Harrison Ford at the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And he would kick the shit out of you. He looked that good. I mean, he was still cut and everything. It's ridiculous. And he's 70. Go, old guy, stand in shape, yay. And that's my news, folks. Take it away, Tim.
Ooh, I have to follow that news. Your saga, the epicness of Matt's news. Well, my news starts off with a little bit of news from cinemablend.com, and their article that I'm going to be mentioning is called Google Claims It Can Predict Movie Box Office with a 94% Accuracy. And they say that Google has revealed its study, Quantifying Movie Magic with Google Search, on a blog post in the piece. The tech company says they begin studying data 4 weeks out from a release date, measuring search data regarding the film's title, trailers, marketing assets, franchise popularity, and the season in which the movie is opening. They use all of this to come up with a ballpark opening weekend figure, said Andrea Chen, Google's principal industry analyst for media entertainment. She says, quote, in the 7-day window prior to a film's release date, if a film receives 250,000 search queries, more than a similar film, the film with more queries is likely... Am I saying that right? Queries?
Query. Yeah.
I'm saying queries.
You can say query.
I can say query?
You can.
Is that
most people
politically
would say
correct?
Query or query, but...
Would I sound like a bad guy for saying query?
I don't know.
In this context?
I guess just go with... Query.
Query? Query?
Yeah, just be on the safe side. Just say query.
Okay. The film with more queries is likely to perform up to $4.3 million better during opening weekend. When looking at search ad click volume, if a film has 20,000 more paid clicks than a similar film, it is expected to bring up to $7.5 million more during opening weekend. End quote. Google says that it reached the basics of this formula by analyzing the top 99 movies of 2012. You know, that's kind of weird to me that Google can come out and say, based on what our users, the people that use Google, click on, we can tell you what will be a success just by the number of clicks, just by what people are somewhat interested in. I mean, people can be like, well, this looks like crap, but you know what? I'm going to look at the trailer. Or people could be like, ooh, this looks good, look at the trailer and be like, oh, that was crap, and I'm not even going to go see that movie. Does this mean that people are actually watching a movie based solely on marketing alone? Or is Google really this inventive and ingenious? I don't know what. Hopefully, I can give Google more credit, but, you know, I'm kind of leaning more towards that people are now watching movies and going to see movies just based on ads and entertainment, what comes on during MTV or what pops up during Real Housewives of yada yada yada.
I think what it's leading into, though, it's almost like a circular logic in a way. in that, remember when I talked about last week, I guess it was last week, with the trailers being too long?
Mm-hmm.
And I talked about The Onion making a movie out of the 90-second clip. They were going to take a trailer and make a movie out of it. I really think that's where it's going. Because people are becoming so interconnected and they are using the internet so much that it turns into... Google can tell, because they will... People are interested in this type of movie or this actor, and then all of a sudden, boom, a trailer pops up, or an article about a movie that they're going to be in pops up, which generates interest and discussion, and then people are, oh, I'm not going to see that, and then they invariably don't. For instance, I told someone today about The Purge, and I was like, just wait to Redbox it, and they're like, wow, don't even rent it? Wait till Redbox? That's actually saying something now. And it took me a minute, but I was like, you know, that's true. Because not only am I saying, don't go and spend money on this movie, don't go rent this, don't buy it on DVD, don't even wait to rent it. Wait till you can spend $1 on it. And I think that's what Google's getting at. It's just following the money, follow the clicks, follow what people are looking at.
True.
So I think you're making, I think, but it just turns into this big circle jerk where the Hollywood is going to start looking at this. And then I think they're just going to try and start using this information to make crappier movies, or make it harder to get movies to be less crappy. I don't know. I see this information being taken out of context and used the wrong way.
Esther Williams passed away. She was the swimming champion turned actress who starred in amazing Technicolor films of the 1940s and 50s, which she is best known for her aquatic musical number that she would do. She was in such films as Easy to Wed, Neptune's Daughter, and Dangerous When Wet, which I think is Matt's tagline whenever he was a pole dancer in the early 90s, Dangerous When Wet. She has performed with multiple famous actors on the MGM contract list, such as Gene Kelly, Frank Sinatra, Red Skelton, Ricardo Montalban, and Howard Keel. Again, she passed away this past week in her sleep at the age of 91. Esther Williams, we will miss you. Matt, did you ever read the Archie comics back in the day when you were a wee tot?
I did. Back before Kevin Smith prophesied that Jughead was gay, I did read a few Archie comics.
Well, his name is Jughead.
I don't know. I always think of... See, I guess that's how not gay I am, because I think Jughead and I think jugs as in women's breasts.
Well, I know I do too. I was just trying to...
But apparently he was gay the whole time, and he did come out a year or two ago or something. So now Jughead's gay in the comics.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it kind of weird that they have to do that sort of thing now just because of culture and the change of... I'm not saying that, you know, a change in culture and a change of what we are used to is a bad thing, but it seems like they do it purposefully in comic books just to make it known that they are not a one-track product.
I guess. I don't know. For me, I think that when people do things like that, they misconstrue tolerance for acceptance, because they are two different words and they have two very different meanings. I think it's one of those hearts in the right place kind of thing. They're trying to do the right thing and they're trying to be supportive, but they go about it in the wrong way. The road to hell is paved with good intentions, whatever, blah blah blah. And I think that when you push people to accept things by putting things that they may or may not be comfortable with, or maybe pushing an envelope or pushing a boundary for the sake of doing so, I think that the people that you're trying to reach miss your point. So I think that there is a time and a place for that kind of stuff, and that I think that especially in the comic book world, where you have the ability to create a universe and have people who are willing to accept that universe in any way, shape, or form, that you can create a world instead of having to force fit, you know, square peg, round hole kind of thing. Tangent, sorry about that.
Oh, no, it's fine. In this Archie news, now this is an example of polar opposites. I mean that as in, this is amazing how there are rumors about a movie and the plotline of the movie, and then somebody that actually is working on the movie comes out and says, that plotline is incorrect. This is the real plot outline, and it's completely opposite. The reason why I am kind of amazed by these polar opposites is that a couple weeks ago, the rumor of the new Archie movie, which was going to be called Afterlife with Archie, was going to be about Archie and zombies. Archie and his gang battling zombies. And the concept was to balance the gore with, quote, elements that are quintessentially Archie. This is according to Archie creator, publisher, and editor John L. Goldwater. However, most recently, Variety has defeated Deadline's report, noting that the Archie movie will not involve zombies whatsoever, and will instead be a coming-of-age comedy in which Archie faces a teenage midlife crisis and must find his purpose in life before graduation. Holy shit, that is completely opposite from Archie battling zombies. Instead, he's going to be battling puberty and voice changing and pubic hair. That's going to be the zombie right there, the zombieified pubic hair coming out, I'm sure. So, again, polar opposites. Once a rumor gets out, people, and people like, you know, myself, who will read it and accept it as truth without really questioning its authenticity. So yes, there will not be Archie with zombies in Afterlife with Archie. It'll just be Archie and puberty. Puberty with Archie. There we go. That's going to be the title. Puberty with Archie. Now my last piece of news. Movie production companies, whenever they put out the money to develop posters, the ideal poster that a movie wants is the type of poster that will catch the attention of a passerby, to pique the interest of somebody to go and see that movie that they are looking at the picture of. Now with the upcoming Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy movie, The Heat, they have a poster of the two of them standing right next to each other. Melissa McCarthy is kind of in the background carrying a bazooka, and that is what the, you know, that's what the poster is. However, if you look at Melissa McCarthy's face, and I will add as a side note that Melissa McCarthy is not a anorexic-looking woman. She has some meat on them bones. She is a hefty woman, and she is one who is proud of her weight. You know, she's not ashamed of it whatsoever. However, the marketing folk, the people who put this poster together, went through and digitally or airbrushed the shit out of her face to where her face belongs on probably Sarah Jessica Parker, not on Melissa McCarthy. Her body is there, but her face is not there. It is ridiculous. I implore everybody to check this out because this is ridiculous because it is so obvious. It is so delicious to look at. So again, this is the advertisement for The Heat, and I think that is the end of my rambling on for my news.
Good job. That does mean that it is time for Three Squares. This week's Three Squared is a very interesting Three Squared. It is good movies where the main character dies at the end. You know, I know what you're thinking. How the fuck can you have a good movie if the person you care most about dies? Well, we're about to show you. We've got six examples here, and I gotta admit I'm cheating. So I'm gonna have to have Tim go first, because the one title that I'm cheating with will be able to lead into the movie segment with it. So I will save mine for last, and specifically my little cheat for the very last one. So Tim, take it away, sir.
Matt, I wanted to tell you this off recording, off broadcasting, but you're my little cheat.
that brightens my day so.
Okay, so whenever I look at movies where the main character dies at the end, not only are there a lot of these movies available, but I look at the movies to where the lead character emotionally impacts the movie, and whenever they do die at the very end of it, it leaves the audience, including myself, completely heartbroken and not quite sure what to do after the movie is over. Even though, in these three movies that I've chosen, this is basically what happens. You know, the movie is going on, the movie is phenomenal, the entire movie depends on this character, and at the very end of this movie, the character accomplishes their goal in some way, but then they die. And you don't know if whether you should die at the end with them or carry on with your life, because carry on with your life seems a little bit weird. With saying that, my three movies are Children of Men from 2006, Arlington Road from 1999, and Cool Hand Luke from 1967. Arlington Road is the phenomenal high-tension thriller starring Tim Robbins and Jeff Bridges. It's a great movie. It's about a well-to-do guy, professor at a college, who has a brand new neighbor, Tim Robbins, that turns out to be a terrorist, pretty much what he is. He builds bombs and he blows shit up. He is a terrorist. However, if you'd ever saw the movie, I just completely ruined it for you. And from here on out, major spoilers, because we are basically ruining the ending of the movie. throughout the movie, the tension is building. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know if Jeff Bridges is going to if he's actually going to figure out that Tim Robbins is a terrorist. But when he does, will Jeff Bridges figure out where Tim Robbins planted the bomb so he can get rid of the bomb, or he can, you know, arrest him or do whatever he's going to do? But at the very end, you know, once he's trying slowly figuring out where the hell the bomb is, he finds out that the car he's been driving, the bomb is actually located in the trunk. And not only does Tim Robbins' character succeed in blowing up the building that he was wanting to blow up, but in doing so, he kills the only man that could have ratted him out. It's a phenomenal movie, and the ending is pretty damn sad. The next movie, Children of Men from 2006, stars Clive Owen. This is a movie that Alfonso Cuarón directed. I guess one of his most... I guess in the Harry Potter world, he is known for directing the third Harry Potter movie, Prisoner of Azkaban. Most recently, you will be able to see his next film, Gravity, with George Clooney and Sandra Bullock, which looks phenomenal. Now, Alfonso Cuarón has this way of creating movies with these characters that are so human, you can just relate to his characters completely. Children of Men takes place in the future, in a world where nobody is having babies. It is scientifically impossible for people to have children, for women to bear children, until all of a sudden this one girl gets pregnant. Somehow she's the virgin. She's like the Virgin Mary. And Clive Owen's character is tasked to save her because there are people out to kill her, to keep her from having the baby. So the entire movie is basically a survival film where he is trying to take her virtually through these battle zones to safety, to her heaven. And at the end of the movie, he dies. He dies on the boat that takes them to prosperity. And it is absolutely sad because, again, this is a character that you have hope for and that you want to see succeed. And he does succeed. But in order for him to succeed, he has to give up something. And what he gives up ultimately is his life. It is definitely a tearjerker. And it is also a phenomenal action movie, mystery movie, and thriller. Lastly is the classic Cool Hand Luke from 1967, starring the phenomenal Paul Newman. I think Paul Newman, by far, is one of the greatest actors, one of my all-time favorite actors. This movie is wow. This is definitely the quintessential Paul Newman movie. Because it was in this movie when you learn that Paul Newman can eat 50 eggs. And it is also in this movie where Luke will do anything to break out of jail. He will do anything to live life his own way. In the eyes of some people, he's a bad guy. But in your eye, in the viewer's eye, he is a phenomenal man. A nice man, a great man, a great man who deserves to live his life because he is ultimately a very happy man. And what is incredibly sad about the movie is that he dies at the end of the movie because he was attempting to live out a happy life, and he gets shot. There's a lot more to these movies. I'm ruining the movie, but I'm actually ruining every single one of these movies. But of course, with any movie that is good and worth seeing, the ending can be ruined. It's ultimately the journey that leads you and takes you to the ending that is well worth watching the movie, regardless of what you know about the movie or what you don't know about the movie. So I implore you, please watch these three movies and let me know, either personally or email us or even comment on the show, what you thought about them. Children of Men from 2006, Arlington Road from 1999, and finally, Cool Hand Luke, 1967.
Well done. All right, so I'm going to kind of make Tim look bad. Here are mine. I'm going to give you mine up front so that if you haven't seen these, you can then go see them and then come back and listen. In this order, Saving Private Ryan, Pan's Labyrinth, and End of Watch. Okay? Now, if you're not going to let me have End of Watch, Gran Torino. Okay? But I think you'll let me have End of Watch, especially once we start discussing it. All right, so from here on out, though, you have been warned. Spoilers abound. First off, Saving Private Ryan, 1998. American epic war film. All right, this is Steven Spielberg. This was a movie my granddaddy went and saw, and he made it about 5 or 6 minutes into the movie, and he had to get up and leave because he was an amphibian driver. So he knew exactly what those men were going through, and it was very hard for him. He could not get through the storming of the beach because it was that realistic. If that gives you an idea of just exactly how realistic and how good this movie is, then you either have seen it or why the fuck are you still listening? Pause this shit, go see it, and come back. But this is the story about a young man whose name is Private Ryan, and a squad of men who have to go and rescue him. The reason why they have to go rescue him is because he is the last in his line, in his lineage. All of his brothers have died. They're all in the army or the armed forces. They've all died. He is literally the namesake for the family. Without him, his lineage dies. The army says, well, we can't let that happen. This family has clearly suffered enough. Go get him. So they form a team, and the team is headed by Tom Hanks. So you would think that with a name like Saving Private Ryan that the movie's actually about Matt Damon's character of Private Ryan, but it's not. It's about Tom Hanks's group of men who go to find him. Tom Hanks is an English teacher. They don't tell you that until very close to the end of the movie, and it's a lot of fun because they have a lot of fun with it, trying to guess what he did for a living. Nobody can figure out what he did for a living. And he has this remarkable way about him that instills confidence in people, but it's a quiet confidence. And he's cool under fire. His men love him, and they work together to find this guy. And there are some very real discussions about what makes this kid so special. Why does he get to go home and we have to stay? And it follows the camaraderie of men during those times, and ultimately these men, not quite to a man but almost to a man, died trying to get this guy out. And ultimately Tom Hanks is mortally wounded, and by the end of it Tom Hanks says, you know, you have to live a good life, promise me that you'll live a good life. And thus he slips off. This movie is touching in a way that really only Steven Spielberg can do. I don't think there's another director who could have elicited this kind of emotion out of a viewing public, much less been able to help craft these actors' performances in such a way. This is one of the best movies I have ever seen, and it deserves to be viewed, I would say, annually, if nothing else, on Memorial Day. But this is definitely a good movie where you find yourself, you attach to these guys, and you understand that even when they die, it's okay because they get Ryan out. And the movie is about saving Private Ryan. So that's the first movie. Second movie, Pan Labyrinth. It's a 2006 Mexican dark fantasy film written and directed by Guillermo del Toro. This was, I want to say, my first knowingly introduction to Guillermo del Toro. I may have watched some of his other stuff prior to this. I don't know. I can't really say off the top of my head. But I was introduced to this by Mike, actually, the lead guitarist for Cries of Solace, actually. He's like, oh, man, have you seen this movie? And I was like, no, what is it? Oh, you've got to check this movie out. It's so awesome. So we sit down and we watch this movie, and I've got to say, this is one of the best fantasy style movies that I have ever seen. It takes place in Spain in the early summer of 1944, just after the Spanish Civil War, and it's a young little girl. Her father died. She's with her mommy. Her mommy's pregnant by the mother's new husband, who is a general or something like that, colonel, high-ranking officer, and he is out to crush the rebellion. And this little girl is basically, they go out to this kind of house in the middle of the woods, a grand home and everything, and it's connected to a seeming like a fairy tale world where a long time ago, a princess Moana, she was in the fantasy underworld and was exploring and got lost and ended up finding her way into the real world. She cannot remember her life in the underworld and thus lives as a human and presumably this young girl. And the movie follows the adventures of her as she is trying to stay out of the thumb of her new stepfather, who is trying to quell a rebellion, where she kind of gets caught up in it. But at the same time, this young little girl explores the ground, stumbles across her true calling, which is that she's a princess trying to get back to the underworld, and has to perform a series of tasks in order to do so. And it weaves this plot of fantasy meeting reality in a very, along with another cryptic plot of the overthrow of the Franco government and everything just after the Spanish Civil War. And you're rooting for this little girl the whole time, and just no matter which way she turns, something amazing happens, but it's followed immediately by tragedy, and you're just like, oh my gosh, it's gotta work out. And then, bam, stepdad shoots her, kills her on the spot. Don't worry, stepdad pays. He pays for it. And it's one of the best shot in the head scenes I've ever seen in my life. And yet, this movie is so well crafted, so well executed, so well shot, and the special effects are just freaking ridiculous. That even though you're sad that all these things go wrong for this girl, and that the girl ultimately dies, the way that it ends, you're still happy. Because even though she dies, and you've lost this whole thing, and it's just all this death and tragedy, the fantasy still interweaves even into the tragic ending of the movie, and you're still like, wow, this is so cool. And then you get to see like who the queen really turns out to be, the queen of the underworld, who that really turns out to be, and how everything ends up working out. And it's just an amazing movie. Oh god, you gotta see this movie, please. It's subtitled, but just fantastic movie. So please see this movie. Last but certainly not least is the movie that will lead us into the movies section of the show, End of Watch, the 2012 American thriller drama film, written and directed by David Ayer, or Ayer, whatever. Stars Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Peña. I gotta be honest with you, this is the only movie that I can think of where I have ever liked Jake Gyllenhaal, or Gyllenhaal, or however he says his name.
Really?
I can't think of anything I have ever liked him in. Ever. Huh. This movie is just fantastic. I just want to say, because again, spoilers abound at this point, so I'm going to clear the fact that when we get to the movie section officially, we're spoiling the fuck out of this movie. I just want to sum this up real quick, because we're going to talk about it in great detail. This movie is truly outstanding, and there's two main characters here. It's Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Peña, and one of them ain't going to make it. Even still, I literally, first time since I can remember, tears, bro. In the feels, tears. I was actually upset. But it didn't, not in a bad way. I was just sad because that's what the movie is supposed to evoke. But it's still a fantastic movie. I wasn't even mad that somebody died at the end. It's that good. I really liked how, to me, it seemed like they never lost the police procedural side of things. It seemed very realistic to me. So it just, the whole time, it's just keeping you just completely wrapped into it. It's not a perfect movie, but it is a fantastic movie. Unfortunately, one of them doesn't make it. We'll spoil it in full, I'm sure, by the time we get through the movie section. But even so, still a fantastic movie, and I wasn't sorry any of these people died. So, 1998, Saving Private Ryan, 2006, Pan's Labyrinth, and 2012's End of Watch.
Nice.
Yes. So let's do it. Let's jump right in. Are you ready?
I am ready.
The movies! All right, well, cool. So the movies that we're going to be covering this week are End of Watch, which we're going to just jump right into from here, Miller's Crossing, and The Purge. So as you can tell, 4 out of 5 stars for me on End of Watch. Tim, what are you thinking? We can go into more about why I think it's 4 out of 5 stars, but you've already heard me say most of what I want to say. What did you think of End of Watch?
You know, this is one of those movies where it's not a perfect... The movie does have flaws. It's not a perfect movie, but given what the movie is and how much I loved the movie or how much I thoroughly enjoyed the movie, I still gave it, if I had to give it a star rating, 5 out of 5 stars. Because what flaws the movie might have, I was able to look over it and fully enjoy it. Not only was the movie kind of semi a found footage type of movie scenario. Because, in fact, in the production of the movie, they shot the movie with multiple cameras, so they had a ton of footage. So the director, David Ayer, said that whenever he first started writing the movie, the first draft of the script started as a pure found footage kind of movie. And he says, quote, "In pre-production, I gravitated very quickly towards augmenting that stuff with normal operating cameras. In editing, I had all this footage, which me and my editor built the movie out of, with never worrying about genre expectation," end quote. And he said that he had tons of footage to play around with. So, he's editing a movie that is partly shot with this camera that Jake Gyllenhaal carries around with him in the movie, because he's kind of making his own little documentary type project about life working as a cop in the horrifying South Central portion of LA. And then you have these cameras that they wear on their cop uniforms that captures what they're doing as well. And then mixing with all that, they also have the standalone film cameras, or I guess they're digital movie making cameras, that they intercut with. So this movie has just like this fantastic blend of perception and perspectives that it adds to the drama, it adds to the characterization, and it adds to the intensity that the movie has going for it throughout the entire hour and 50-minute runtime. Whenever the movie needs to be sweet and loving and caring, whenever Jake Gyllenhaal's character is falling in love with his girlfriend and marrying with the girlfriend, that's usually whenever they show that, they switch from the movie cameras to the home video cameras that he uses to kind of get that feel that, oh, you know what, this kind of feels like real life. It feels like we're watching a home movie. This director was phenomenal in picking at all of our emotional core by taking things that we are used to seeing and adding that aspect to the movie to give it depth, to give it characterization, to make it as human as possible. So it was just fantastic. And I will say that this is the type of found footage movie that completely works. I mean, I think all other found footage movies they are going to make in the future, or that they are even thinking of making in the future, they've got to take a page out of David Ayer's book, because what he did was something fantastic. Now, that's just the technical side. On top of that, you have the acting. And unlike Matt, I love Jake Gyllenhaal. He was in Brothers. He was in Zodiac. He played Robert Graysmith. He was in the film adaptation of the play Proof, where he played Hal. He was in Brokeback Mountain, which I thought he was phenomenal in. And among other movies, including Donnie Darko. I mean, though it's kind of an overrated movie, he was still good in it. And if you want to see him playing a very wacky character, check out Bubble Boy, because surprisingly, he brings joy and laughter and humor to the character of Jimmy Livingston in the movie Bubble Boy. And then finally, his portrayal of a young Homer Hickam in October Sky. That was the first time that I've ever heard of Jake Gyllenhaal, and the first time I've ever seen Jake Gyllenhaal. And oh my god, wasn't that a fantastic movie to be first exposed to an audience in such a way? I mean, I guess his very first movie was actually playing Billy Crystal's son in City Slickers, which I did not know that. I'm kind of looking at his IMDb page right now, and that kind of just popped up there at the bottom. So, all in all, I will say that End of Watch, in my mind, is a fantastic movie. Though it does have flaws, you could easily look over them because of how realistic this movie is, and how damn entertaining this movie is, and damn, what a phenomenal job. And that is how I will end it.
Very cool. Yeah, the only thing I did not like about this movie was the stunted way that the time passed in the movie. You never got a real sense for how long the movie is, or the time period over which, or when exactly the movie takes place and for how long the movie is taking place. That kind of bothered me a little bit. Again, right. Forgivable. And one thing that when they were stressing kind of the found footage aspect of this at the beginning of the movie, when you have Taylor and Zavala they respond to a public disturbance call, and it's a Blood gang member named Trey. He and Zavala get into a fight, and the camera's really shaky, and it's trying to catch all the angles, and you got all this stuff going on, and that was really bothering me. That aspect of the cinematography was really bothering me. That's the worst thing, and thankfully it's at the beginning of the movie. They don't do it anywhere near as much after that. As a matter of fact, some of the found footage in that regard is actually pretty cool. There's a fisheye camera at the end of a shotgun. That scene, there's a scene there where that's going down, and that's kind of really cool. So they do some really interesting things in regards to the cinematography, but instead of having a cop's feel, it's just kind of an annoying feel that almost breaks the wall a few times. It's not, again, it's more pervasive at the beginning of the film than by the end. I don't know if that's intentional or not, but it's definitely something that is completely forgivable and totally resolved by the end of the movie. However, it's that style that promotes the time, that kind of time shift where you're not really sure how much time is passing as things go. 4 out of 5 stars for me, 5 out of 5 stars for Tim, and thus is end of watch. Michael Peña dies.
Wow, wow, wow.
Oh, I told him we were going to spoil it for him, so I guess we should really spoil it for him there at the
this
end.
Is,
right?
I think this is the all most right, spoiliest so, show we've ever had, we've ever done.
Well, it's definitely a spoiler. It's spoiler for that we've had for a while. I'm pretty sure our twist ending 3-squared one was definitely the worst.
Probably.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so I guess next up, Miller's Crossing, a Coen Brothers flick from 1990. Gangster noir. What'd you think, sir?
I think it's a good movie. This is the Coen Brothers' third movie after Raising Arizona, and then their first movie, which is Blood Simple. It's a bit slow at first, but the movie pays off by the end of it. And what I really liked about the movie is that it's a gangster movie, for those who don't know that. And it flows like the murdery mystery flicks of the 40s and the 50s. For instance, what, you know, you were talking about The Maltese Falcon last week, to where The Maltese Falcon, it's kind of slow at first, but when you get into it and you get to know the characters and the storyline and you get an idea of what the quirks, you know, that are happening in the movie, you start to appreciate it, and then you start to enjoy it, and then you start to get into it, and then you start to anticipate what's going to happen, and then by the time the movie's over, you realize you enjoyed the movie. And this is how I felt with Miller's Crossing. It has phenomenal acting by both John Turturro, who I think one of his best performances I have seen, and also Albert Finney. I thought Albert Finney played a great mob boss in this movie as well.
Who was the first person?
Did I say his name? John.
John Turturro.
John Turturro. Did I say John Turturro?
I don't know.
I think I purposely slurred it just to.
That's fine. Awesome, John Turturro. Okay, very cool. Yes, I definitely love him, and I'm glad he gets used in the Coen Brothers films. So, yay. All right. Well, what we have here is a gentleman by the name of Tom Regan. Okay, now he is basically the confidant, the ear, the man behind the man, so to speak, of Leo O'Bannon, who is played by Albert Finney. Now, because this is the Coen Brothers, and this is early in their career, they had actually tried to get Trey Wilson. Okay, now this is the guy who played Nathan Arizona in Raising Arizona. Or my name ain't Nathan Arizona! And I don't have any idea how this movie would have played out if Trey Wilson had gotten the part. I would have liked to have seen it, don't get me wrong. Unfortunately, he died 2 days before shooting was supposed to begin, and they got Albert Finney instead. Now, I will say that Albert Finney does a fantastic job, and there's a particular Oh Danny Boy scene in this movie, and I swear to God, I never thought Albert Finney was a badass until I watched that. I was like, you gotta be fucking kidding me. That was just ridiculous. At any rate, I digress. Sorry. Tom Regan, who is played, I think, rather magnificently by Gabriel Byrne, is the longtime confidant of Leo O'Bannon. Okay, now this guy is a Irish mob boss, but he's a mob boss, but they play it off more like he's politically connected. He is, but he's basically just an Irish mob boss. Now, he runs a city. This is Prohibition era. We have a guy by the name of Johnny Caspar, who is played by John Polito. And he's a great character actor. You'd know him if you saw him. He's basically the Italian rival, but it's more like he understands that he's in Leo's world and he has to abide by the rules still. He needs to knock off a bookie for selling information about fixed fights. Leo decides to protect the bookie and say, no, I'm sorry, you can't kill him. We need him. He's under my protection. He's paid for it. What good am I if I don't honor my protection? Now, what the real story is, is that Leo is actually hooked up with John Turturro's sister. Now, John Turturro plays Bernie Birnbaum, which is the bookie. Marcia Gay Harden plays Verna Birnbaum, his sister. And so, of course, Verna wants to protect her brother. She doesn't quite realize what a snake in the grass he actually is. But hey, family's family. Gabriel Byrne, Tom, he sees this as a bad play. He's like, this girl, first of all, the girl's not worth it. Second of all, Bernie is not worth saving. Even if the girl was worth it, Bernie's not worth saving because if you protect him, you're just going to piss off Caspar and start a war that you could very well lose. Albert Finney, Leo, he doesn't listen. And it turns out, though, that there's still a little bit of a love tryst going on because Tom also has his eyes set on Verna. And Verna reciprocates. So you have all this going on behind Leo's back. As the plot thickens, we come to find out Tom's willing to do whatever it takes to protect Leo. And that means even exposing himself as Verna's lover behind Leo's back. Anything to make sure that Leo understands he's losing his grip. Compounded with all of this, Tom is a gambler. And he is not having a hot streak right now. So he's owing money all over the place. And this creates an additional complication because everybody's offering to pay him off because they want him to get Leo's ear to either kill Bernie or for Bernie to say, hey, I'll give you the money so you can keep me alive. And then Verna's like, I don't care, let's just leave. And Casper's like, hey, screw Leo and Bernie, I'll give you the money. And that's when Tom sees that he can start to play both sides against each other. And he does. Expertly. There are a couple of times when some things happen that you're like, wow, you don't see it coming. But he is able to expertly pull things, and his machinations work to a certain extent. They don't work in other areas. He gets his ass kicked just as much as he kicks ass in his own Machiavellian way. And it culminates with bosses fighting bosses and cops killing people and people firing cops with fire bombings. It's really just it's really a great movie in terms of that. It does, as Tim say, it does start off slow, but paying attention and allowing it to let it run its course, you get to see really cool scenes play out, like Albert Finney being a badass. And John Turturro being just an ultimate snake in the grass. It's just so fantastic to watch him work. You also get to see a young Steve Buscemi here. There's just some really cool stuff going on. And as much as things work out, they don't. And I don't want to spoil it for you because the ending of the movie is probably one of the most unique endings ever. And as much as the film has serious notes and there is some tension, it's not a thriller. But as much as there is tension that gets built, the score is so light and it's literally fluffy. You think you hear the score at the opening and you hear the score at the end, and then of course you hear the main theme bouncing around occasionally in the middle, and it's almost like a Pillsbury cookie commercial. You just kind of feel good, even though you're like watching maybe somebody die. Or something bad's happening, or the movie's ending and you're like, interesting, really? You see how this stuff kind of pans out, and the music just keeps you smiling.
Yeah.
Even when you're not sure whether or not you should
Especially the humor helps the movie out as well, because it's chock full of the Coen brothers, Joel Coen's humor. It just is.
It is. And what also, though, that I really liked about this movie was they went all in on the dialogue. This was straight up noir gangster style, you know, 1920s, 30s gangster, without a doubt, all the way up to the kiss off and are you the turn, are you the screw, and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it was really cool just to listen to the vernacular going full steam ahead. It was I was all about it. It really made it a lot of fun. I really wish that more movies would take this tack when they are covering this kind of time period. But I gave the movie 4 out of 5 stars here. I thought it was a good... I really thought that it was a good movie. It's a bit of a slow start, but again, I don't think I found it to be as slow as Tim did. But really, for me, it was because of the music. The score just kind of kept me all light and fluffy on my toes and waiting for it to heat up. And then when it did, it holds you. So I think it's a great movie. I definitely would recommend watching it, especially since it's on Netflix.
Exactly. And like I said before, that this movie reminded me of the classic noir movies of years ago. Many of Miller's Crossing, many of the situations that take place in Miller's Crossing, as well as its characters and dialogue, are derived from Dashiell Hammett's work. A number of Dashiell Hammett's work, particularly his 1931 novel *The Glass Key*. Many aspects of it, some dialogue and some characterization, was taken from that key. I mean, the movie isn't necessarily an adaptation of the book, but it definitely pulls some of the nooks and crannies from that book and, you know, from the storyline. So the good thing about the Coen brothers, especially Joel Coen, who was one that directed the movie, he put a lot of work and a lot of thought into this movie, and he did a phenomenal job. I mean, you can't expect anything less from a Coen brothers movie.
It's also cool to see the people you see, like Frances McDormand, she's in this movie, then like we said, John Turturro is all up into this movie. So it was really kind of cool. And then, of course, had he lived, Trey Wilson would have been in this movie. And I think it's just kind of interesting how even this early in the game, you see the uses of the same people over and over again in the Coen Brothers movies. Sweet stuff. All right, so last but not least, The Purge?
Yes, sir. Let's get purged.
Now, The Purge, there's really not a whole lot to say about this movie, unfortunately. At the end of the day, I gave it 3 stars, mainly because the premise is a great premise, and when the movie builds tension, it does a fantastic job of actually building the tension. So that's where I give it my 3 stars. I would say I like the movie. However, the way that they take advantage of the premise to move the plot forward, every time they have the payoff of the tension build, and then they have something that is there to move the plot forward, it yanks you out of all that action. You're left sitting there going, what the hell? This is stupid. I went into this movie with, wow, this looks really cool. I'm very excited. Started looking really good. The tension was kind of interesting, and the way things were kind of looking to shape out, I was like, wow, this is going to be a 4-star movie. Then about halfway through, after the 3rd time, I'm like, these people are fucking stupid. I dropped it down to 3.5 stars. I was like, well, as long as it keeps going, I'm only at 3.5 stars. Nope. And then by the end of the movie, the actual climax, the culmination of everything of the movie, I'd yank that 0.5 star because it just goes completely stupid. In the words of Robert Downey Jr. from Tropic Thunder, never go full retard. They went full retard. By the end of this movie, it just completely threw me out. The only person who I think even bought the ending of the movie in the movie theater when I saw it was the girl sitting in the front row who was scared by every fucking stupid thing in the movie. She literally jumped. She literally screamed. We were laughing at her by the end of the movie.
So she enjoyed the movie. So you paid,
I guess so,
to enjoy her enjoying the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, we all got purged. This is one of those movies that the premise alone gives the movie a star. I mean, how can you go wrong with such a great premise? You know?
What is the premise, sir? Well, I guess we should, just in case anybody hasn't heard or doesn't know yet, what is the premise?
In the future, what is it, like 2027 or something like?
No, 22. It's just 10 years.
Okay, 2022. The government implements this new thing, this new law, that once a year for a 12-hour period, everything is legal. All crime is legal. And there's this family, Ethan Hawke is the father, that is inside of this house, and they kind of hunker down in there because this is, I guess, what they're used to happening every year for 12 hours. And they eventually get terrorized by these masked evildoers. And that is basically the plot. And it's one of those futuristic movies where it's kind of like, oh, you know, in some twisted world, I can totally see this happening. And this movie easily could have been a play on society, kind of like the 80s John Carpenter's movies, like with They Live or whatever. You know, it could have been like one of the, or even Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It could have been a play on society or something about the government relying on anything else to cure humanity or to do something with humanity than, other than relying on the government themselves to actually do something. You know, just something like that. It could have been a social commentary. But instead, they just kind of play the obvious and play The Purge like a normal, run-of-the-mill slasher flick. And it does have its perks, but those perks kind of run out of steam after a while if the entire movie is just being carried by the plot and these one or two or three perks alone. So you have all of that, and the movie just really doesn't amount to anything much. So we're going to get a sequel out of it. And the movie was a monster success for Blumhouse Pictures. I mean, the movie was only $3 million to make. And last week alone, it grossed $36.4 million at the box office. This is insane. So, of course, The Purge sequel has been announced. It is currently in development. I guess Universal is doing it. And what's crazy, what is very interesting, is that Blumhouse, production company is named after its founder, producer Jason Blum. This is not his first box office success for a movie that turns into a franchise. The other low-budget horror movie franchises that he has produced were Paranormal Activity, Insidious, and Sinister. All these movies have sequels coming out, or have already had sequels out. So
that is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then I guess that's that.
That is that.
All right. Well, then let's go ahead and jump into the spiel.
Spiel on.
Yes, sir. The music, as always, that you've been listening to has been brought to you by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com. You can also check them out at ReverbNation.com, MySpace.com, or Facebook.com/CriesOfSolace. As far as we are concerned, you can check out the SLS Cast by going to Facebook and searching the SLS Cast. You can also go to our website, SLScast.com. You can send us an email to theSLScast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, @theSLScast. And, of course, you can subscribe to us on iTunes. And I guess we shall bid Tim a fond farewell and safe trip and aloha. And we will see you back in a couple weeks.
Yes, sir. What are you guys watching tomorrow or next week? Did you announce that?
Well, next week, I guess, Sam and I, again, we're going to be skipping the news and the three squared. And we're just going to be doing This Is the End, The Professional, and The Total Recall Remake. However, we will be back in 2 weeks with Tim and I, where we will be doing the three squared for favorite movie openings, as well as movies being Man of Steel. Don't worry, we'll have all seen it before then, but you know how recording works and everything. We're just waiting until he gets back there. Man of Steel, The Paperboy, and Dogtooth. And that will be all. So aloha, Tim.
Aloha, listeners.
And you have a great time, guys. We'll see you next week.
Cheers.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.